What he wants to do is for people to embrace science while maintaining that sense of enchantment from the past.
Because the sun is pure, the sun is able to use and enjoy the magic without it corrupting him.
Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were, I will not believe.
But you wouldn't clap yet, because making something disappear isn't enough. You have to bring it back.
There are no new words under the sun. There are no new notes I have left to hum. There are no new rhymes yet to be sung. There are no new chords that strings haven't strummed.
3, 2, 1. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Unreliable Narrators, where we discuss media, literature, and the arts, and how they relate to Christ, the self, and the world. I'm Raymond Docapel.
And I'm Sophie Beloncle.
Sophie, are you a fan of magic?
Yes. I grew up reading fantasy stories of any kind. Often they were terrible. Cough, Christopher Paolini. But I read them anyway.
Right. Well, I don't actually mean that kind of magic in the terms of fantasy. I mean just like magic shows, sleight of hand, that sort of thing.
Oh, yes, of course.
Because there is
anyone not?
There is a difference between those two things.
True.
I mean, one of them is very much emphasis on performance and the visuality of things. I mean, mm-hmm. The word magic is used rather loosely, right?
Yep.
I mean, we have dark magic, obviously, like demonic magic. Mm-hmm. Then we have Disney magic, which is just any kind of, like, nice, beautiful, warm, fuzzy feeling is referred yes. to as magic. And then we have sleight of hand magic. And I always loved watching card magic growing up as mm-hmm. a kid, and I still like watching card magic, but I never got super interested in figuring out how they did it.
Mm-hmm.
I was always more interested in presentation. I don't know, do you ever watch Penn and Teller?
I have seen a little bit.
Okay. So they're, like, pretty famous magicians, but they talk a little bit about how magic is done and mm-hmm. how the majority of the case, it's misdirection. So a lot of the times, it's either, right, they create a distraction so that you're looking at something else, or they just start telling a story, and because your mind is occupied with following the story, that you don't see what they're actually doing the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so magic, sleight of hand magic always fascinated me because of that.
Well, actually, so my little brother Ransom, who has Down syndrome, he loves card magic. He loves sleight of hand magic. And what's very funny, you've probably seen this when you've interacted with Ransom before. He has a deck of cards and he'll stop you and tell you that he has a new card trick. But when he does the card trick, it's just, you know, he shuffles it and he goes through all the motions of a sleight of hand trick. He'll have you pick a random card. He'll have you put it back in the deck. And then he'll reveal a card and he has all the motions down perfectly. But the card isn't your card because it's just, yeah, I mean, he doesn't know how to do the trick. And the thing that's interesting to me about that is that he is so uninterested in actually learning how to perform a trick. Like, we've tried to teach him really simple tricks before so that it could be an actual magic trick. He does not want to do that. He's actually unconcerned with the fact that it's not a real magic trick. And it's unclear to us whether or not that's because he thinks that the sleight of hand is real magic. They're just able to perform magic with cards, and so there's no way for you to teach that to him. Like, he just is, you know, maybe it'll work someday, maybe it won't, but that's, like, not the important thing, is how to do the trick. Which I think has a little bit to do with the topic that we're discussing today, because I think there is a question of, is the magic real or not? Is it a trick? And there's a character in this story who I think maybe is unconcerned with whether or not, like, how you do the trick.
Right. I feel like every story about magic is always trying to play with that idea. And I think the movie that does this really well is Christopher Nolan's The Prestige, which mm-hmm. we're going to talk about later. But the topic of today's episode is the short story, The Magic Shop, by H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells has come up in this podcast before, namely as C.S. Lewis's main rival.
Not favorably.
So the Space Trilogy was written as meant to be an anecdote to H.G. Wells, but I think it's time we delve a little bit into H.G. Wells himself. I think it's only fair. He is considered to be the father of science fiction in the sense that he wrote most of the books that began that whole genre, and he coined the term the time machine. He was the first to invent that, and he was a futurist. He was a utopian, so a lot of his science fiction stories had a very positive view of the future, science and technology. It's really only until much later when you get into Huxley's Brave New World where dystopian fiction starts cropping up. And H.G. Wells, to his credit, did write some dystopian visions of the future in which, technology has been utilized in a way for political power and the warnings against that. But on the whole, he was very positive towards science and technology. Very common for 19th century optimism at the time. He was definitely the forerunner of that. So it's curious, given H.G. Wells' background, that he would write a story like this, like The Magic Shop, because it's not really explicitly, at least upon first reading, have anything to do with science. It very much is meant to be a sort of 19th century magic story that's, a little bit romantic, because it's about a father and a son who visit this mysterious shop by a mysterious shopkeeper. He is a very caricatured character. He's described as having his chin is like the tip of a boot. So you can see the sort of cartoonish figure. And a lot of strange things happen in this shop. So, Sophie, you want to kind of give a rundown of what happens in this story?
Sure. So it's not much more complicated than what you just said. Basically, we have a father and a son. The son's name is Jip. I don't think we ever learn the father's name. They're walking down the street one day, and they see this magic shop, and this son, Jip, really wants to go inside. The son is portrayed as... He's not a petulant or whiny kid. He's very gentle and very nice and lovable, which is part of the reason why you kind of root for him throughout the story. And, I mean, there's more hints later as to why that might be important, but he's a good kid. And so his father takes him inside the magic shop, which is where Jip wants to go. And there's this kind of mysterious, weird shopkeeper person who immediately is like, let me show you some magic tricks. And he starts pulling like these glass balls out of things. And at first it seems like pretty typical. Like you can imagine you might go into a magic shop and the shopkeeper might do some tricks for you to try to get you to buy some tricks. But then the shopkeeper makes clear that he's not really there to sell stuff. He says that people leave the shop with magic, but only if they're the right sort of person. So he says that Jip is the right sort of boy, whatever that means, for these tricks. And he starts showing more and more kind of outlandish, crazy magic to the point where the father starts going, I don't know if this is fake. This might be real magic at this point. But the whole time he keeps saying that it's a little too real, a little too plausible for his taste. So he never really acknowledges that he thinks it might be actual magic. He just kind of gets scared and says, well, this is too much. This seems too real for me.
Right. He keeps on coming up with explanations every single time the trick gets more and more outlandish. Right. He says it must be this. Yep. It must be that. Part of that is because he's getting increasingly nervous.
Whereas in contrast, the son, Jip, he seems totally unconcerned with how the tricks are done. Just like Ransom, right? He's going around, he's seeing the magic, he's totally in awe, he is not scared at all, he is totally unconcerned, and doesn't want to know how it's done. He's just excited to see all this magic, and he totally buys into it. He believes it's real magic.
And actually, I think the trick that really starts making the father nervous is the trick where the shopkeeper seems to be able to control whether the door is locked or unlocked. Right. So somebody tries to get in and it's locked, they can't get in, and he says it's locked for them, but not for you because Jip is special. And right. So I think part of the father's concern is just the fact that this guy can lock us in if he wants to. Like, maybe this right. is a trap. Maybe that is one of his concerns, too.
Yeah. He comforts himself as they kind of go further and further into the shop about how we can leave whenever we want. We can leave. And eventually, the shopkeeper is able to kind of get Jip away from the father. In the beginning of the story, Jip is described as holding onto his father's finger. He seems very young. He might be 5 or 6. Very, very young kid. And at some point, the shopkeeper is able to kind of entice Jip away with magic so that Jip is holding onto the shopkeeper's finger. And the father doesn't really like that either. He's starting to get concerned at this point. And sort of the climax / ending of this story is that the father starts kind of having enough. He has a conversation with the shopkeeper, and Jip disappears. Jip is gone. And the shopkeeper, like, sends the father, I think through a door, if I'm remembering correctly. There's this door, he kind of pushes him out. The father kind of tumbles through blackness, and then boom, he's on the street, and he turns around, and there's his son, there's Jip. So Jip is okay, they go home, but the shopkeeper sends some tricks, I think just to their address. And one of those tricks is a set of toy soldiers that supposedly march around on their own. And the father asks Jip, like, do the toy soldiers do anything? Like, do they march around? And Jip is like, oh, well, I wouldn't like them if they didn't. Of course they do. But the ending of the story is that the father says that he drops in unannounced many times while Jip is playing with the soldiers to see if he can see the soldiers moving on their own, and he never does. Very, very Polar Express kind of ending there. And then at the very end, he says that he keeps trying to go back and find the shop so that he can settle the bill, so that he can pay for the magic tricks. But he can never find the shop again, and he finally is like, I'm sure that they know our address. They can send the bill to us if that's going to happen at some point. And then that's the whole thing.
Yeah, and also we should talk a little bit about this. One of the tricks that the conjurer does is make a little demon appear.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And this is a really strange happening. So what goes on here?
Yeah, so I'll actually just read the passage. It's pretty short. I felt him pull at something that clung to my coat sleeve, and then I saw he held a little wriggling red demon by the tail. The little creature bit and fought and tried to get at his hand, and in a moment he tossed it carelessly behind a counter. No doubt the thing was only an image of twisted India rubber, but for the moment... And his gesture was exactly that of a man who handles some petty, biting bit of vermin. I glanced at Jip, but Jip was looking at a magic rocking horse. I was glad he hadn't seen the thing. I say, I said, in an undertone, and indicating Jip and the red demon with my eyes, you haven't many things like that about, have you? None of ours. Probably brought it with you, said the shopman, also in an undertone and with a more dazzling smile than ever. Astonishing what people will carry about with them unawares. So I think we've got a couple of interesting things there. The father, according to the shopman, brings this demon in with him. So the shopman is just revealing this demon that's already there, that the father already has with him. And then Jip, totally unaware, right? Jip is looking at this little magic rocking horse thing. He doesn't see the demon. It's as if the demon doesn't exist for him. So I think that highlights, first of all, maybe something about the father's character, but then also tells us something about the fact that the father and Jip have totally different experiences in this magic shop. The father experiences it as a place of fear and a place that causes trepidation and concern, whereas Jip experiences it only as a place of, like, the Disney store, right? It's a place of magic and wonder, and it makes him totally happy. He's not at all fearful.
And there's another passage here, which I think is very interesting and telling, and that is how the shopkeeper is described. So he says, quote, "He said very little, but his eyes were eloquent. The clutch of his arms was eloquent. He was the playground of unspeakable emotions." So that's a very interesting choice of words there, because you don't describe, it's a very surprising adjective, because you don't describe eyes as being eloquent. But that definitely fits for, you know, the way magic shows work, right? Because your eye directs what the audience looks at. So the eyes say everything. I mean, magic is a very, at least performative magic, sleight of hand magic, is 100% based on visuality. There is no, you can't do a magic trick on the radio. I guess you could. You could just be like, stop talking and be like, where'd you go? But it would be silly. So your eyes have to be eloquent. So that does seem to suggest that there is some sort of sleight of hand going on here. At least that's what that passage suggests that. And yet H.G. Wells, the author, seems to be constantly alluding to the fact that, but it isn't, right? There's something else going on. And then a little bit later, the shopkeeper says, "We, none of us, know what the fair semblance of a human being may conceal, sir. Are we all then no better than brushed exteriors, whited sepulchres?" And he sort of trails off. So again, that goes back to what the conjurer is constantly saying. I mean, he says this more than once. Astonishing what people carry about with them. Everybody is concealing something beneath the surface. But what is even stranger than that is the fact that the human being is not even called a human being. He says the fair semblance of a human being. Now, that's such a strange thing to say, because basically what you're implying is that you, the father, Jip, are not even human beings. You are semblances of human beings. That's his vision of the world, is everyone is a semblance of a human being. And human beings are, for him, brushed exteriors and sepulchres, meaning were tombs. What in the world is he saying about this? Obviously, H.G. Wells is not coming from a religious background, so he probably doesn't believe in the supernatural world in the traditional sense, but he believes in something. So, what does he believe in?
Well, there's a really obvious biblical reference here that we probably shouldn't overlook, which is that when he says, "Are we all then no better than brushed exteriors, whited sepulchres?" Whited sepulchre is just another way of, like, a sepulchre is a tomb, and whited is another way of saying made white or whitewashed, right? So he's using the phrase whitewashed tombs, which is the phrase, obviously, that the Bible uses to refer to the Pharisees.
Jesus.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, Jesus calls the Pharisees.
Yeah.
Whitewashed tombs.
Yeah.
So I think, though, what's interesting is that it seems like in some way brushed exteriors and whited sepulchres is the conjurer's judgment on the father. The father is a brushed exterior. The father is a whited sepulchre. The father is the one who brings a demon in with him, right? There's all sorts of kind of like pronounced judgments upon the father, whereas the only judgment on the child, on Jip, is that he is the quote-unquote right sort of boy. So we've got the father who, it seems like there's more that's wrong with him even than we see in this one story. We don't really get a lot about his background. We don't learn too much about his family except for this one son. Except for the fact that he seems like there's maybe more going on than meets the eye. He's maybe a worse person than he lets on. And so therefore, I'm not sure what to make of this yet, but he experiences the magic shop as something terrifying because he is not, because he is a brushed exterior and a whited sepulcher, because he's a whitewashed tomb, because he is a Pharisee, the magic shop is horrifying. But then because Jip is pure, because Jip is an innocent child, the magic shop is good and beautiful. And I think maybe that one of the biggest questions for me in this story is one of them correct? Like, is Jip seeing the magic shop correctly and the father is seeing it incorrectly for some reason? Or is the father seeing it correctly and Jip is seeing it through, like, naive, innocent, rose-tinted glasses because he's a child? Or are they seeing the same thing and who they are is just changing the way that they see it? Is the magic shop good? Is the magic shop bad? Is this conjurer a Satanist? Is he, you know, pulling demons out of thin air because he is somehow connected to evil spirits or to an evil world of magic? Or is he a good guy who's terrifying to the father because the father is evil in his own way? I'm not sure what to make of that yet.
I don't know. It's a very ambiguous story and definitely lends itself to multiple interpretations. But I can provide what I think. I mean, this is my interpretation, and it has some problems because there's nothing in the text itself that would lend it to this. But I'm basing this off of just what I know about H.G. Wells as a person, because I know that H.G. Wells was a very pro-science author. I mean, so again, writing a story about a magic shop, that's a little bit strange, but knowing H.G. Wells really believes in the efficacy of science to bring about the utopia. And I think he really wants his audience to be enchanted by science and believe and to say, look, all these stories of witches and demons, the supernatural in the past, these things that enchanted people, this is now made possible by scientific innovation. And what he wants to do as a storyteller is for people to embrace science while maintaining that sense of enchantment from the past. And so, as an author, I don't think he really has a particular belief in, like, the reality of science. I mean, in the reality of magic. But he wants you to believe in science as being magical. And I think that he is also riffing on sort of biblical allusions, and as a way of sort of springboarding him off of a narrative that is quite different from the original intent of the biblical narratives. He's utilizing the trope of, he's utilizing the image of faith like a child. So Jip is the child who has childlike faith in magic, which from Wells' perspective is really science, and the father is just kind of backward and superstitious, and so he's the one who doesn't get it because he's not really embracing the future. So I think he wants us to become like children, so to speak, and from his perspective is to be progressive and embrace the innovations of the 19th century.
Well, actually, okay, so if we run with that interpretation, I think that there are a couple things that opens up about the story that makes certain things in the story that make more sense if we view it through the lens of that interpretation. I think the first thing is it makes more sense out of the generation gap between why it's about a father and a son, because it does tend to be true that the younger generation is the one that just kind of accepts whatever technological advancements are happening, whereas the older generation is a little less likely to go with the flow and accept it. Like, everyone knows, Gen Z, anyone who's growing up right now, who grew up with a smartphone, first of all, would not be able to function without one, and second of all, has no memory of what it's like to operate without a smartphone, is mostly unconcerned about a smartphone, and has a brain that's wired to use a smartphone. So younger generation just kind of accepts the fact that this is the way that the world is, whereas, like, my grandfather has trouble, like, figuring out how to text. He actually, okay, so he has an iPhone, and it'll tell him every week how much screen time he spent last week, you know, like it does for everybody. And apparently the story is that at one point, at the end of the week, his phone told him, last week, your screen time was 1 minute of screen time per day. That was the average. And his response was to go, oh no, I have to get that down. Because that was too much screen time for him. Whereas for the rest of us, we're like, oh my gosh, we spend way more time on a screen than that every day. So anyway, just to highlight the fact that it would make sense then that the son is the one who just kind of accepts the magic, and then the father is the one who's a little bit more skeptical, a little bit more concerned about it. And the second thing that I think it kind of opens up for us is, so Hank Green, who's the brother of John Green, who wrote The Fault in Our Stars and a lot of other stuff. And Hank Green is the science guy, right? So he has YouTube channels where he talks about science stuff. And he's really interested in kind of popular science. One phrase that he's kind of known for saying is, we need to learn to trust the experts again, something like that. So basically, one position that he has is he's tired of people saying, like, do your research. Do your own research. So if, like, figure out whether or not XYZ claim about science is true, his position is, there are experts who know about that. You don't need to do all your own research on everything, just the way that you don't need to necessarily know exactly how your car engine works, or you don't necessarily need to know, like, exactly how every single electronic device in your house works. Someone built this device and knows how it works, and you use it trusting that it's going to work. And so you don't have to do your own research for everything. You can trust the experts, that the experts knew what they were doing when they made this claim or when they did this research, etc. And there might be something a little bit like that going on here, because the child reacts with a very childlike faith to the magic that's going on, and he doesn't question it. He doesn't go, wait, but what about this? And how does that work? And it feels like this isn't possible. He just accepts. And I wonder if H.G. Wells is maybe advocating for something similar to the Hank Green position, which is someone brought about this magic, someone made this technological advancement, or someone did this study or did this research, and you are not going to physically be able to fact check every single claim or technological advancement that happens. So maybe you need to sit back and be a little bit more of a child about it and trust the experts and allow them to do what they do so that you can do what you do.
Right. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it depends on... I think that there's something to the idea that you can't research everything. Like, when I buy a cake mix and the recipe on the box says that I need to have 2 eggs and half a cup of vegetable oil, I'm not going to go research whether or not that's true, right? I'm not going to spend the time to be like, wait, but should I have 2 eggs? What if I had 1 egg? What if I had 3 eggs? Or like, what do I need more oil than that? What if I don't need oil? I'm not going to research it. The people at Betty Crocker presumably know how to bake a cake better than I do. But then there are maybe claims that we should be questioning and we shouldn't just be taking with childlike faith. So I think there's maybe a balance when it comes to figuring out what we're going to just accept and what we're going to trust on faith because we have to and because it makes sense to do it, and then what we should be more wary of.
Right. I mean, yeah, it really depends on who is saying trust the experts, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, we the 20th century has certainly taught us that what technology can do when they're put in certain hands. Christopher Nolan is obviously very concerned about this. A lot of people are very concerned about this. We talked a little bit about Oppenheimer, which is Christopher Nolan's most recent film. But I think that in interest of this particular episode, it's very important for us to bring up one of Christopher Nolan's earlier psychological thrillers called The Prestige, which I think
is also maybe his best movie.
It might be,
I would say.
It might be one of his best. It's certainly one of the most complicated and challenging and intriguing of his films, but it's very much definitely on brand with 19th century science and magic sort of in an arms race against each other. I mean, it's a period drama. It stars Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman as these two rival magicians. And there's a horrible magic accident where Hugh Jackman's wife is killed in the accident. And Christian Bale's character blames Jackman for the accident, and this sets off a rivalry between the two of them, where their tricks get increasingly more intense, more showy, but there's also more duplicity. Yes, there's increasingly more duplicity, and the secrets behind them become increasingly dark. And I guess, for the sake of this discussion, I am going to have to spoil a little bit of what happens here.
And it is a movie you need to watch unspoiled. So if you have not seen the movie, skip like 5 minutes ahead.
Well, maybe I won't go too much into the details then. But basically, I can't remember what the character's name, so I'm just going to call him by the actor's name. So Hugh Jackman pairs up with Nikola Tesla. And there you have the intersection of science and magic. He uses a fictional invention by Tesla in order to accomplish his conjuring act. And murder is involved. Let's just say that. It involves murdering a person. Should I say more than that?
No.
Okay. I won't say more than that. But one of the things that is behind this message, Christopher Nolan's message, is in the 19th century specifically, there was this kind of enchantment with science, therefore equating it with magic, and yet it might come with a horrible cost.
Yeah. Well, I think a quote from The Prestige that is helpful and important on a couple different levels when we talk about that theme is the opening monologue, which is also the closing monologue of the film, which has even more meaning if you've seen it. So if you haven't seen it, then I guess you'll, once you see it, this will have more meaning for you. But the quote is, well, actually, no, first of all, I should say, the very first line of the movie of The Prestige is, "Are you watching closely?" Which is so important because everything that happens after that, and even in the whole theme of the idea of science and magic and things happening that we don't quite understand yet, all of that relates to this question of you have to be watching closely, right? If you're going to be able to see what's going on, because it's moving so quickly and the things that are happening might be horrible. They might be wrong. It might require murder to do your magic trick. And so you have to be like paying attention and watching closely to see what happens. Okay, but here's the quote. "Every magic trick consists of three parts, or acts. The first part is called the pledge. The magician shows you something ordinary. The second act is called the turn. The magician takes the ordinary something and makes it into something extraordinary. But you wouldn't clap yet, because making something disappear isn't enough. You have to bring it back. Now you're looking for the secret. But you won't find it because, of course, you're not really looking. You don't really want to work it out. You want to be fooled." So I think there's a couple things there that are helpful in the context of this story. And I think the first thing is maybe starting at the end with the idea of you're looking for the secret, but you won't find it because you're not really looking. You don't really want to work it out. You want to be fooled. Raymond, do you think this is true? Because whenever I go to see a magic show, I always feel like I do really want to know. But if I did know, I think I'd be disappointed. So maybe I don't really want to know. Maybe I want to be fooled.
Oh, no, I definitely want to be fooled. I once saw a hypnotist come and do a performance, which was very entertaining. But he definitely primed the audience at the beginning. So the first thing he said is, "You are totally in control. you just don't care, right? You're just very relaxed. Second, he says, you have to want to be hypnotized or it's not going to work. Third thing he says is, you have to be kind of smart. Now, I don't think the third one was actually true. I think that he was just saying that to make you a little bit more susceptible, because if you...
To make you want to be hypnotized.
Yes, because it means that you're smart. And it was a very entertaining show. He calls a bunch of people up there. He plays this very relaxing music, and then he says something, you know, he says, you know, just calm down, take deep breaths. You want to have a good time. This very, like, soothing voice. And about, you know, 2 minutes in, he opens it up, and, you know, he gets them to go do all sorts of crazy things and pretend to be in a fashion show and everything. And so, anyway, it was fun. But definitely... You are participating in making the illusion happen. If we are to map that and connect that back into H.G. Wells' story, I feel like we could uncover a little bit of a dark undertone here. Because he seems to be sort of defending the child's position. Like, you should just accept this like faith like a child. But does this mean that there's something going on behind the scenes that's a little bit sinister? Like, maybe there's a murder taking place, but because you want to be enchanted, you want so badly to be enchanted by this that you're willing to overlook that.
So actually, speaking of The Prestige, since we've been making all these connections between The Prestige and this story, The Magic Shop, I think it actually might be helpful to compare. So there's one really small scene in The Prestige that involves a young child who sees and comments on a magic trick. And it's not really, in general, a movie about children. There aren't lots of children in the movie. But there is this one really compelling scene in the movie where there's a young child, a boy, who's watching this magic trick. I think it's Robert Angier, Hugh Jackman's character, who's doing the magic trick, but it's not super important. And the magic trick is he has this cage that has a bird inside, and he smashes the cage down, and the bird is gone. And then the kid starts crying the minute that that happens. And then he goes down to the kid, and he's like, no, don't worry, it's okay. And he pulls the bird out of thin air. And the kid, still crying, says, but where's his brother? And then Robert Angier looks at the kid's mother and says, he's smart, isn't he? And later you see him in the back room, and he opens up the cage and the bird is squashed. He's dead in the bottom of the cage. So the kid saw immediately what had to have happened in order for this trick to work. And I do think it's interesting to compare those two children, because in both The Magic Shop and in The Prestige, the child is the one who sort of immediately is able to see through to the truth of the trick. There's some sort of special vision, special sight that both children have. But in The Magic Shop, the child is enchanted by the magic and views the magic positively and isn't super interested in how the trick is done. It's less important for the child, for Jip in The Magic Shop, to see exactly how the trick is performed. It's more important to him what the trick is. It seems like in The Magic Shop, he's unconcerned about the source, like the underside of the trick, because he doesn't think that there's something nefarious about it. He has seen through, he's the right sort of boy, he knows that it's okay, he knows that it's positive, it's good. And then on the other hand, the child in The Prestige immediately sees through to the dark side, the dark underbelly of the trick. He sees the trick and immediately knows that there's something wrong, there's something nefarious going on.
Well, this is why there's always a distinction made between being childlike and being childish, right? Because being childlike is a good thing, but being childish is a bad thing. And yes, I think it is interesting that you point out that the child is being used as sort of like a device for the insight of what is really going on. Either the person who sort of validates the conjurer as like, this is true magic, or kind of indicts the conjurer as a con man or someone who has got evil or darker intentions. What I think is interesting is that if we compare H.G. Wells's attitude towards, you know, science and magic and the sort of futurist of 19th century optimism with Christopher Nolan's sort of retroactive analysis of 19th century optimism, we definitely see a case of where maybe hindsight is 2020 a little bit. And we have Christopher Nolan is definitely much more interested in showing a dark underbelly, and he's using the child to expose the dark underbelly. Mm-hmm. And this is where we get to the interesting difference between grown-ups and children in The Prestige versus The Magic Shop. Because in The Magic Shop, the grown-up is the doubter, the person who thinks that something is wrong, and he's shown to be incorrect, and the child's point of view is vindicated. But in The Prestige, it's actually the reverse. Because in The Prestige, we have the child who has the insight that says, okay, there's something wrong with this trick. And it's all the grown-ups who are willingly blinding themselves. They're the ones that want to be fooled. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is very interesting, because that is, again, a dividing line between childlikeness and childishness. Becoming like a child to enter the kingdom of heaven is not necessarily being foolish. I think that that kind of childishness is what is being criticized and challenged in The Prestige, because all of the grown-ups are too willing to let those things slide. They want to be fooled, yeah. Also, it's interesting the question that he asks, but where's his brother? Because the first person to ask that question of another person was God in Genesis. Where is your brother?
Oh!
And so that, I think, is a really good example of the first magic trick in the Old Testament. Cain made his brother magically disappear, and God said, how did you do that trick? And Cain says, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? A lot of these magic tricks of making people disappear means just making them disappear forever. And then in this case, like, you kill the bird and then you bring it back. There's a trick, because it isn't really the same bird. You duplicated it. You made another bird. That bird is gone. I'm not going to tell too much about how this works out in The Prestige.
Yeah.
But we can talk about how this happens in the Gospels later on, because this is also a person who disappears. And the real question is, when he came back, was he the same person?
Well, actually, that perspective makes so much more sense of the last lines. Let me read it really fast. Okay, so in the story, the conjurer, pretty much right when they go in, they're talking about, like, buying magic tricks, and he makes it clear that, oh no, like, they're free, right? They're only for the right sort of person. So there's no actual cost to this. Which I think is also kind of connected to the idea of the secret, right? If there's a cost to the trick, like in The Prestige, then that's also connected to the secret. So there's a price, and then the price might be connected to, you know, whatever is going on behind the scenes that allows the magic or the science or whatever you want to call it to be happening. But then the last lines of the story are, there's also a question of finance. I have an incurable habit of paying bills. I have been up and down Regent Street several times looking for that shop. I am inclined to think, indeed, that in that matter, honor is satisfied, and that since Jip's name and address are known to them, I may very well leave it to these people, whoever they may be, to send in their bill in their own time. That now reads to me as pretty sinister. Like, they haven't paid for the magic, right? They haven't paid. There's a deferred cost of some kind. And I'm maybe a little bit concerned, especially because we make it clear that since Jip's name and address are known to them, that maybe it's going to be the younger generation who in time is going to pay. And actually, to connect that maybe a little bit to the idea of smartphones, where smartphones were introduced into the economy at a time when the older generation was old enough that their brains can get a little bit rewired, right? You can still get addicted to a smartphone if you're older, but you didn't grow up with it. You didn't spend your formative years on a screen. Whereas the generation that is growing up now, most of them don't even have any memories of a time where they don't have a screen. And that is totally rewiring their brains. And I think there is a deferred cost to that. There's a bill that comes due later for that, that is not necessarily a cost that is totally apparent right now. So I wonder if that's maybe part of the point too. There's a cost to the trick. There's a cost to the technological advancement or to the science or to whatever you want to call it, that has to be paid by JIP, that has to be paid by the younger generation in a way that the older generation can't pay for it. Like, he's trying to settle his bills. He's trying to find the shop. He can't find it. It's going to be JIP that's going to get the bill in their own time.
Right. And I don't think my concern for me with technology really is a little bit more nuanced than just technology equals bad. And I think we can really connect this especially to the current concerns about artificial intelligence, because, again, this conversation comes up every single time there's a new technological innovation of, you know, what's it going to do to us as human beings? We are going to become less human, or we're going to be replaced, so on and so forth. But the concern with artificial intelligence is very much a science fiction fantasy, because people are always saying that the artificial intelligence is actually going to gain some kind of sentience and is going to become more powerful than humans, so on and so forth. But there is a danger in artificial intelligence, and I think part of it is the belief in its power. I think that is what really concerns me. Really, it is the power of a graven image, an image to confer reality and to dictate things, that we believe, that we come to believe that this thing is actually superior to us, and then it starts giving orders that we now have to obey because we believe that it's superior, when in fact, artificial intelligence is just a reflection of our darkest impulses. The imagery of mirrors actually does come up here in the magic shop, which I think is interesting. Mirrors is definitely a big part of sleight of hand magic. And this makes me think of Psalm 135, which talks about idolatry. So in Psalm 35, verse 15 through 18, psalmist says, "The idols of the nations are silver and gold, made by human hands. They have mouths but cannot speak, eyes but cannot see. They have ears but cannot hear, nor is there breath in their nostrils. Those who make them will be like them, so all who trust in them." And I think that last verse is a perfect summary of the real dangers of artificial intelligence. Not that they will actually learn to speak, hear, think, but that when we make them, we will become like the dumb idols that we make.
I think that's really insightful. I also think that it helps us a little bit in the context of this story to understand how the magic shop can be so sinister, and yet also H.G. Wells is not anti-science, right? Because the father is the one we're seeing the perspective of the story from, and we have talked, I mean, we talked earlier in the episode about how the father brings in his own demons, right? The father has problems, and the son is pure, right? The son is presented as innocent. And so there's a difference in perspective, and we talked about the question of, so is the magic shop one thing that they both experience differently, or is it two different things? And each one of them is right, or is one of them wrong? And I think maybe the answer is, the magic shop is one thing. It's a complicated thing, but that the sun, because the sun is pure, right? Because the sun is innocent, the sun is able to use and enjoy the magic without it corrupting him. He is master over it because of this purity and because of this innocence, which I think is maybe what the Conjurer means when he says that he's the right sort of boy. Whereas the father, who brings in his demons that have to be a little bit pulled out of him, right, when he's in the magic shop, he brings in his own demons, he brings in his own issues. The magic shop is terrifying for him because he sees it as the master of him. He's concerned about getting usurped, right? Like, Winjip takes the hand of the shopkeeper, of the conjurer, instead of the father starts getting worried that the shopkeeper's replacing him, that the conjurer's replacing him, which maybe we could connect to your point about AI. He's worried about being replaced by a technological advancement or something that is different from him. But that's only able to happen because he is not pure. He does not have the innocence of the child. It's not because one of them is wrong. It's because they are just different people. They experience the same thing. One of them is a good thing and one of them is a bad thing just because of who they are. Which reminds me a little bit of The Great Divorce, which we used to talk about all the time, and I think it's been a while since it came up. But one of the key ideas of The Great Divorce is that heaven is a good thing and a beautiful thing if you are good, right? If you are purified, if you are saved. Whereas it's actually a really painful, horrible thing if you are not. And that the place isn't any different. It's just who you are. That if you are pure, it is one thing, it is a good thing. And if you are impure, then it is a difficult and painful thing to experience. And I do think that that is something that we see here in this story, that the father is impure, the father brings demons with him, and that maybe for him to experience the magic shop as something positive, as something that is full of magic, which ultimately is going to be good and be good for him, that he would need to have his demons exorcised before he comes in, rather than coming in and having them all pulled out of him, right? And that the son experiences the magic shop as something positive because, you know, because he's pure. So that's one takeaway that I think we could have.
I think the biggest takeaway for me is we need to redirect our attention away from the appearances, from the images, and redirect it back onto humanity, onto the human being. And I think that that is one of the main emphasizing points of the Gospels, especially when it comes to the flesh and blood humanity of Jesus Christ, the God-man Jesus Christ, human and divine, is we are not to sort of emphasize the spectacle. We are to look at the human being, look onto the face of Christ, which I think that by doing that, we are sacrificing a little bit of our enchantment. But what Christ is promising is to us is that we will become re-enchanted. You know, we will become a new nature. So becoming like a child for Christ, when you're following Christ, is a little bit different I think that the appeal to becoming like a child is something that puts us in a very vulnerable position and maybe puts us at the mercy of people who may not have our best interests at heart. So that is a reason to be skeptical of this story of who are you becoming like a child for? And so I think that one of the things that the Bible teaches us is to look away from the smoke and mirrors and look at the conjurer's hand, to look at the eloquence in the person's eyes and to see how the trick is being done.
I think the thing that I'd add to that is the ending of the bill that the bill is going to come due. I think that that is a huge part of the ambiguity of this story. Because if the magic shop is good, if the magic shop is something like a positive spiritual world, if the conjurer is anything like an angel or anything like Christ, then maybe the magic really is free, right? Maybe the father thinks that there's going to be a bill that comes due because that's how he's used to the world working, but that's not how this magic shop works, and that's not how this shopkeeper works, because it really is free. There's a gift that is free. Or maybe the magic shop is questionable. Maybe it's a potential problem. Maybe this is a darker spirit world. Maybe the conjurer is not like an angel or like Christ. Maybe the conjurer is like a demon or like Satan. And maybe the bill that comes due is gonna be not so great. Maybe it's not gonna be something that he or Jip want to pay. But we don't know in this story, and I'm not sure that H.G. Wells knows. I think that the ambiguity is part of the story, and that kind of goes back to what you were saying, which is you have to watch the conjurer's hand. You have to know and be able to identify whether this is good magic or whether it is bad magic. And that's the only way to know what the bill is going to be.
But also, again, there is definitely, when we talk about the prestige, there is a death and resurrection motif going on there. There's, you know, the pledge, the turn, someone disappears, and then he says you have to bring him back. And you're like, okay, well, this sounds very much like the resurrection. It's like, yeah, it was. That's what Christ did. It was a magic trick. And are you supposed to look at that and say, how did he do it? What was the magic? I think that this is probably why G.K. Chesterton said Christianity was such a perilous religion. Because he wants you to be Jip. He wants you to just accept that, not ask how you did it, be quote-unquote fooled, like just sort of suspend yourself and just like allow that mystery and just sort of bask in it. So another thing that is really interesting about when you watch a traditional magic show after the magician makes something disappear and brings it back again, he usually tries to double check things. Say like, okay, like look in the box, make sure it's really gone. I mean, he's encouraging you to check it all the way through the trick. You know, make sure it's the same person. I've got nothing, you know, this, I really did it. It was real. And of course what he's doing is, you know, he's trying to help you in the project of making you believe that what he did was real. But of course he is, still telling you where to look. His eloquent eyes are telling you to look in the box. Well, it's okay for you to look in the box there because he hasn't hid it somewhere else. You can look up at his sleeves because it's not in his sleeves. He doesn't really totally just say, you know, look wherever you like, unless he knows that it's perfectly safe to do that. So we've been talking about this in relation to Jesus' death and resurrection as being the ultimate magic trick, being the real magic trick, and Jesus being the true magician. And what's interesting is that in the Gospels, this is exactly what Jesus does in the Gospel of John. And this is why, you know, doubting Thomas has such an important role in the Gospels. Because he says in John 20, verse 24, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my fingers where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. And then Jesus comes and stood. Oh, he does one more magic trick, actually. A week later, his disciples were in the house again and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, my Lord and my God. Then Jesus told him, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believed. And I think that there's a lot of things that are really powerful about this. First of all, we see the similarities between the Conjurer and Jesus, but there are some very important differences. The first of them is that when you have a conjurer who's directing the trick, he's the one who invites you to do the searching because he's directing you to look at a certain place. But this is not what Jesus does. Jesus is not the one who initiates that invitation. It's Thomas who says, "I need to look myself." And then Jesus allows him to do that. And then secondly, he goes farther than sight, right? Because Jesus wants you to go farther than sight. And it says it's not about just seeing. The ones who see, who do not see, and yet still believe, are more blessed than the ones who do see and believe. So he's questioning the whole validity of seeing as a gateway to reality at all. I think that all of those things puts Jesus at the forefront. This is how you prove that the trick is real. This is the ultimate way to prove that the trick is real. And then there are still people, you know, you can still doubt it, I guess. You have to, it is, and I think that is where faith comes in. But I feel like Jesus is very deliberately going through all of the ways that we check the reality of something. And he's meeting those expectations and then going beyond that.
Yeah. I think the other thing that is so powerful and fascinating about that story is, first of all, that Jesus does not really chide Thomas too much, right? He pretty much just says, go ahead, touch where you need to, don't doubt anymore, and believe. And then Thomas believes. And I think there's a lot of grace on the part of Christ in that scene toward the fact that humans have this need to check, have this need to know. And he says, like, you know, you're blessed if you see and believe, but then, like, blessed are those who have seen, or who have not seen and believed. That's somehow greater. That's the greater accomplishment. But that it's okay to be a human and to need that confirmation. And that maybe part of the reason that Thomas needed that confirmation is so that we could also have that confirmation. Because if we were Thomas, we probably would want the same thing. Or maybe we don't know what we would do in that circumstance. But I think I might. I think the other thing is that for a lot of magicians, like, people all the time when they talk about the resurrection and they talk about Christ and how can you possibly believe that that happened, are the same sort of people who I think there would not be enough proof that a magician could show them that the trick was real for them to believe it. No matter how many times, even if a magician was performing real magic, it would never be enough for them. No matter how many times they showed, every single spot that you thought the card could be is not there. The only way that this could have happened is through magic. There are people who just would never believe it because they've already decided there's no such thing as magic, which is what the father does in the magic shop. He sees every proof that this is real magic, and he still doesn't believe it the entire time. The whole time he says, oh, this is looking a little too real for me. This is a little bit too plausible for my taste, and that just makes him uncomfortable and he wants to leave. It's real magic, and he's shown what Thomas has shown, and yet he still doesn't believe. So I think maybe we can give Thomas a little bit more credit. Thomas wouldn't have to believe after what he saw. Maybe he's delusional. Maybe they're all delusional. Maybe it's a mass hallucination, which is what a lot of people think happened to the disciples when Jesus was resurrected. So I think that shed some light on the story, too.
Of course, we know what the dangers are of that when we put our trust in humanity. We know that this can lead to horrible things and betrayal if we put that faith, like childlike faith, in someone else, because in those cases, those conjurers, those magicians are murdering someone, they're killing someone, and that there's something dark going on behind that. The difference being with Christianity is that the conjurer died. He died. He actually died. At least that is what he's telling you. He's the one who took the violence, the murder, was on him, and he actually defeated it and came back. You have to believe that or you don't. You have to reject all other religions because, or reject all other magic tricks because this is the one true magic trick. The one true deep magic, as C.S. Lewis would call it, from the dawn of time.
Here's our challenge to you, listeners. Rewrite The Magic Shop by H.G. Wells as if it were The Magic Shop by C.S. Lewis and see how that turns out.
See what happens. Yep. I think it's time for us to disappear now.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Raymond actually disappeared on his camera. A visual bit in our audio-only podcast.
You've been listening to Unreliable Narrators, a Mars Hill podcast. Unreliable Narrators is an original podcast produced by Raymond Dogapil and Sophie Belonkel. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever podcasts can be found. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us, review us, or write to us at unreliablepodcasters@gmail.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/unreliablenarratorspodcast. Our theme song is New Moon by Caleb Klomperens. For our next episode, we will be discussing the famous art piece, The Persistence of Memory, by the Spanish surrealist artist Salvador Dalí. And for our next trick, we will need a volunteer to donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/unreliablenarratorspodcast. We won't be giving it back or anything, but, you know, we'll be metamorphosizing it into a beautiful butterfly of content. So, abracadabra.
I know you can see something inside, the one part of me that I cannot hide. And maybe it's true that nothing is new, but I can see so much more in you. There are no new words under the sun.